What Museums Can Do. Das ist das Thema der aktuellen öffentlichen Ringvorlesung an der Uni Göttingen. Sie hören jetzt die Aufzeichnung von gestern. Es spricht Professor Dr. Sharon MacDonald aus Berlin und York.
Also vielen Dank für die wunderschöne Einführung und also vielen Dank, Frau Beisiegel, und vielen Dank auch Frau Allemeyer für die Einladung. Es freut mich ja riesig, hier zu sein, hier in Göttingen zum ersten Mal, wie gesagt, und hier in diesem ja sehr, sehr imponierenden Aula. Meine Damen und Herren, ich muss um Entschuldigung bitten, weil ich den Vortrag auf Englisch halte. Aber hoffentlich wird es verstehbar. So, yeah, please excuse me for giving the lecture in English. It's partly because it's my scientific language. Also, just these, I began just less than a month ago, and it's very, very hectic. So my brain is better engaged probably still in English. Anyway, let me begin. Last week, as some of you may know, on the 21st of October, it was Back to the Future Day. Now, I have to confess that my past was such that Back to the Future, back in 1985, had somewhat passed me by. But the film that came out that year, the film Back to the Future, which was produced by Steven Spielberg and directed by Robert Zemeckis, was the highest grossing film that year. And what happens in it is that the hero, Marty McFly, travels forward 30 years into the future. So last week, on the 21st of October 2015, that was the day that he had traveled to. And numerous fan clubs, there are just blog sites full of this, discussing what had happened, comparing the reality to the fantasy. And there were even actually some museum exhibitions that were put on to look at Back to the Future and to think about some of these questions. We're looking at past fantasies about the future gazing of previous generations is often very interesting, and actually sometimes it seems very bizarre. So, Back to the Future, how they thought we'd be living now was that we would be flying around in our cars, we'd have flying cars, we would travel as well on these sort of floating hoverboards. One interesting thing was apparently that lawyers, we shouldn't have lawyers anymore, they would have been abolished. I presume that actually the opposite has happened and we have growing numbers. Faxes, the fax machine, this would be a really major form of communication over distances. And there, actually, I wanted to just briefly digress. I think that I haven't used a fax machine for at least 10 years until last week and arriving here in Germany. And I have to confess, I was really quite surprised. So I was... I had to send two just last week, and I really haven't done that. So it made me think that, yeah, even in these times of globalization, cultural differences undoubtedly still exist. There's something about paper, actually, here that's quite interesting. Anyway, one of the things that museums do, and I'm going to keep touching on various things that they do, is to offer up to us visions of the past, how the world was seen at particular moments, including those things that at the time were cutting edge and that were seen as probably going to be having the most significance to the future. More than anything, what museums are repositories of the things that we think are worth keeping for the future. They're the stuff of the past that we want to push forward into the future, the things that we think are worth future generations knowing about us and about our achievements, and the things that we've already collected from previous generations that we think are significant and worth keeping to the future. So that constitution of an archive for the future, and a constitution in that process of cultural value, of what of really something quite deep is going on there, that we're defining the things that really we consider as a culture are really important. Those are some of the things that museums do. But what Back to the Future really made me reflect upon was about how museums themselves, if we look back, have often been predicted to be on the brink of supposedly imminent demise. So when people talk about the future of museums, they quite often put a question mark. Do they? Do they have a future? What kind of future? So the arrival of television was often discussed, or sometimes discussed, as likely to replace interest in museums. Why bother to get out of an armchair and trudge off to a museum if you could now just sit at home and have all the things of the world beamed into your own home? And more recently, it's the internet, of course, that's been seen as the potential challenge to museums. Now, actually, it's quite interesting with Back to the Future that back in 1985, there were sort of precursors of the internet around, but no kind of big publicly used internet, no World Wide Web. Tim Berners-Lee hadn't come up with that yet. That change within this period of time is undoubtedly an absolutely enormous one. And that, again, has been something some people have thought, maybe that would be a challenge to the museum. Why bother going if you could sit at home? Actually, it's quite interesting that these theories do seem to be rather based on a presumption that people are very lazy. They don't want to move if they can possibly help it. They definitely prefer to be a couch potato than actually move. What's remarkable, though, if we look at what's been going on, is that museums, although there's often this discourse about them as dusty and old-fashioned, something from the past, they haven't just survived. They haven't just survived these supposed major threats, but they've actually grown in numbers and strength, including in general, and it's not for every single museum, including in the numbers of people visiting them. Digitizing collections doesn't seem to have stopped people going to museums. I don't think anybody's done a kind of complete study of just exactly what happens in terms of numbers and digitization, but if you look at some specific reports and things, I don't think there's anything that seems to point in the direction of saying that digitization encourages people to stay at home. But on the contrary, am I too quiet? Anyway, so far, what you've missed, museums were supposed to die, but they haven't. They've continued, even with digitization, with these challenges, right? So there you are, you're up to speed. In fact, what I think we're seeing is that putting collections online seems to increase interest. People see what's there, even if it turns out that they're not on open display when they come. I noticed in some of your own information that you included the compelling statistic that 6 times more people go to museums than go to football matches. It's an interesting statistic. When I was beginning work, we used to be really happy to say that more people went to museums than to football matches. So I'm pleased to see that the statistics are going in that direction. It would be wrong, though, here, of course, to ignore the fact that not all museums are doing well. Austerity, in particular, has reduced opening hours in some places, leading to lower visitor numbers, and there are museums that have closed, either for that reason or because of long-term lack of support and resources. But nevertheless, even within that, alongside that, the general continuation and expansion is remarkable. China, which was mentioned, where I've been doing work, a sort of relatively small amount of the work that I do, small proportion of that. I partly went to work there because I was really intrigued by just why so many museums have been opening. So in 2013, 451 new museums opened in China. Each year over the past decade, there have been hundreds. That was a particularly boom year, but there have been 300 to 400 each year. Museums of various scales. The Gulf states are, of course, another place where we're seeing this extraordinary kind of booming of museums that's going on. And as you see from these, the particular kinds of architecture, people talk about star-architecture, having distinctive architecture is one of the things, the aspects of that. Some of those are not yet complete. I will just quickly say what they are. The top one, probably unmistakably, the Guggenheim. The one down at the bottom left is what will be, when it's finished, the new Louvre, designed by Jean Nouvel, who did the Quai Branly. In the middle, there's a museum of the future. And the bottom right, maybe you can guess what that might be, that's not yet built, but it's going to be a police museum in the shape of a policeman's hat, which I thought was quite novel. I couldn't resist that, actually. But it's also, we see many new museums in Europe as well, even though already more museum dense, the scale is nowhere near the same. But we're currently waiting, for example, for a new House of European History in Brussels, Museum of the European Parliament, to take one high-profile example. Something's happening in Berlin, to take another. And, of course, there are plans here, there are plans in many places. More widely, what we see is extensive refurbishment and extension of existing museums, and actually it's hard to know where to start when thinking about that, but perhaps the most obvious place for me to start thinking about that is Berlin, having just arrived. Now we might say, okay, the building of the Humboldt Forum will also see the closure of two existing museums, the Ethnological Museum and the Museum of Asian Arts in Dahlem, with parts of their collections moving into the Humboldt Forum instead. But nevertheless, it's a high-profile construction with its space primarily, though not exclusively, dedicated to museums. So as such, it is a big budget affirmation of confidence in the museum as a critical form, as a cultural form, maybe also as a critical form. And although we should note here too that the two museums just mentioned, the Ethnological and the Museum of Asian Arts, are the ones that are most often discussed, I think, the Humboldt Forum will also contain displays of the Stadt Berlin and of the Humboldt University. So, in effect, two de novo museums. And the Humboldt University, part of the Humboldt Forum, will include some exhibition space that is not particularly based on collections, on Sammlungen, but it will have quite a large space for the university's Lautarchiv, amongst other things. Other museum refurbishments and extensions that my own research project will link into, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later, are refurbishments of the Museum of Islamic Art, which is within the Pergamon, and the Museum of Natural History. And both of those, like the Humboldt Forum, are supposed to open in 2019. Unless airport syndrome strikes, let's see. Now, Berlin is certainly, or in some ways it is distinctive and singular, but it's not exceptional not entirely exceptional in this sort of infatuation with museums. We can look to other capitals, and Paris is a very notable example. Of course, every president always has to have their own museum, though Sarkozy ended up having to open the Cité de l'Histoire de la Migration, which he didn't actually turn up to open, even though it opened within his time period, and didn't get his own museum of the history of France. But many other examples. So the Musée de l'Homme has just opened afresh very, very recently. So just really these examples to make the point that museums are certainly not lying down and giving up. On the contrary, those predictions were as inaccurate as most of those in Back to the Future. So, in planning a new museum here, yes, you're in quite some company, and you're certainly not alone. And in terms of university museums, this undoubtedly is another very interesting area of exciting museum development. And I think what we're seeing is a revivification of the university museum. Now, that certainly varies between countries, between states, and so on, as, of course, does higher education more generally. But overall, what we seem to see is a new kind of interest in and even an embracing of museums by many, if not all, universities. Well, in the UK, where I worked all my academic life until a few weeks ago, except for the occasional Aufenthalt here in Germany and in China, but I was always employed by UK, we've seen various university museums considerably refurbished and emerging with new vitality, attracting lots of interest in the process. So just to give a few examples, so in Oxford, so my alma mater, the University Museum, which is basically a museum of natural history, reopened after refurbishment earlier this year, sort of partly within that complex, the Pitt Rivers Museum, which is an ethnological museum, refurbished, though kept, and in fact both cases, kept a lot of the original fabric. And I have to say I'm very, very glad about that, especially for Pitt Rivers, which has a very deep place in my heart because partly it might be my favourite museum ever, actually. And I was once nearly locked in for a night there, which, you know, that gives you some other sort of special feeling about it. But it even has the handwritten labels of the first curator, so that was all preserved. So that was refurbished, very, very popular with the public, both of those museums, as well as with the university. And the Ashmolean Museum, which has some claims on being the world's first public university, but where there's always competition for these things. But that had a very major and very acclaimed revamp in 2009, really reorganizing how they displayed things and using new architecture in quite innovative ways. Also opening in 2009, and I have to confess, I couldn't, in deciding how to choose things, I decided to just be autobiographical. If in doubt, why not? So this is in actually Newcastle upon Tyne, which is not the Newcastle I worked in, but this is the Newcastle I was born in. And there, this museum, the Great Museum of the North, which was, or it still is, partly university museum, part of a partnership with the city, very, very used by the public and attracting significant audiences. And that was, there was an existing museum and it was very, very developed and transformed. Another case, so Manchester, where I worked for quite a number of years, just earlier this year, the Whitworth Art Gallery, which is one of the university museums, reopened after with a very architecturally interesting new wing, which won a big architecture award, and the museum actually recently won Museum of the Year award by the UK Museums Association for what it did there. But just focusing on architecture and on the fact of these openings misses an awful lot about what's really been going on and what's made museums so lively over these past years. So the Whitworth, for example, has mounted all sorts of interesting and innovative exhibitions, often drawing on and working with academics to do something really, really often quite distinctive and sometimes, quite brave. So, for example, this sort of series of exhibitions, part of the Revealing Histories series that they did, looking at trade and empire. So Manchester's history is really built on the textile industry, and that museum has big collections of textiles. They used that as well to really think about questions of empire, of global connections, including questions about slavery. So doing things that are often quite brave as within the public arena. The other main museum of Manchester University is the Manchester Museum, and that again has had quite a number of has had quite a lot of refurbishment, new galleries, including, and this was just one example, Living Planet. While that's primarily a zoological collection, what they did with that was wanted to display it in a different kind of way. So you can see there some of the themes that they picked up, this one about domination, another called Connect there. There were others that looked at questions of animal symbolism, for example, and I, as an anthropologist, got kind of pulled in to discuss that and came up with some quote about symbolism and snakes and things that, anyway, which is there within the exhibition. So really kind of using some of that resource, though, of the university, the thinking power, to think about how can we maybe display topics that we have displayed traditionally in new ways. And I wanted here, though, to actually just give some examples of some of the actual activities and work that museum has done, because some of it, I think, was very impressive. And why I'm doing it, though, really, is just to illustrate some of the things that not just museums can do, but university museums can maybe especially well do. The first of the project work that I wanted to mention was something called Collective Conversations. And that was an initiative that began in 2004 and was particularly developed by a museologist, a member of staff at that time called Bernadette Lynch. And she really took some of the ideas that were around in museology, particularly an idea about the museum as a contact zone. And that's an idea that was developed by the American anthropologist James Clifford. And she thought about how can I put that into practice. And what she did was, what the museum did was basically set up a kind of film studio, and they would bring out particular objects and bring people in to discuss those. And these films of these activities would then some of them are actually in part within displays, and they form a way of kind of refreshing and renewing some of the displays within the museum. But they also all go up on YouTube, and there are 461 of those if you want to kind of have a look. So they're especially with people from the local community, but that includes the university. So you'll have a mix of people who discuss different kinds of objects. So sometimes university staff, or mixed with other kinds of experts. Another of the things that the museum did, it was one of the early examples of returning cultural property, in this case returning human remains to New Zealand, which it did in 2003. And that was very much something that the then director, Tristan Besterman, wanted to do out of his understanding of museums as capable of forging relationships with people in other places. And that is very much how he understood this issue of returning these particular kinds of things from the collections. And it led to good relationships for the museum. And it also is part of him developing his ideas about the ethics of museums. And so the museum as well became a place to discuss some of those issues. And that, I think, is a very, very important thing that museums can be. They can be forums, they can be places for discussion in that way. And those kinds of acts or events can really crystallize that and help really kind of make it happen. Another of the interesting things the museum did was to cover up its mummies, to put covers on them, and to really, visitors were asked, do you think we should do this? Do you think it's more respectable? More respectful to cover them than to leave them open. And the member of staff who did that, who really came up with this as an interesting thing to do, was Pietro Biankowski. It led to the most enormous amount of debate. It had lots and lots of coverage in the media, lots and lots of blogging about it. It really, whatever you thought about it, it engaged people, and that was interesting. And my last example from there was an exhibition of a bog body, so one of these bodies that's discovered in peat many, many years later. And many things are interesting about that, but one of the particularly interesting things with that was that it was not simply displayed there with whatever sort of scientific knowledge there was about it. And it was Piotr again who particularly developed this exhibition. What was done there was to present it with a whole set of different perspectives of people who had different kinds of relationships to that particular object. So that included forensic scientists, the people who actually dug it up, an archaeologist, a member of the local community, and there's an issue there about its belonging to Manchester as well, museum curators, and also a pagan. So does that make sense? Pagan? Yeah, I can see some frowns. A particular kind of religion, what's a good way of describing it? Weiß man, was das ist auf Deutsch? Das wäre einfacher zu sagen, pagan? Pagan, ja? Yeah? Oh, okay, alles klar. But that, more than anything, really annoyed some people who felt that the voice of such people, new age religion people and so on, shouldn't be heard in the museum, especially a university museum. But in its way, that got a lot of discussion about, well, what should you have and in what ways? And this polyvocal or multivocal way of displaying things was itself a very interesting thing to try. So experimenting with ways of doing things, and actually, although that image doesn't particularly show it, the whole form of displaying that was itself quite interesting. You could kind of go further and decide if you wanted to see the body, if you felt that was respectful or not, as part of the process of visiting. So the visitor themselves was put in the position of taking on board debates and thinking through, how am I going to act? Which I think was an interesting way of doing it. Taking ideas from recent theory about how you might display things, engaging in experimental exhibition, and maybe actually causing some controversy, are things that, back to my title, museums can do. And I might even say to you provocatively that if anywhere is going to do that, perhaps university museums are the places that can, and in some ways maybe should. They maybe should lead the way there. Anyway, that's one of the possibilities for university museums that I think is quite exciting, that they can also there grapple with more sophisticated ideas perhaps than some other museums might. Perhaps they can take the risk of things not always working, than can museums that have to sort of rely on public funding in a different kind of way. Anyway, I've utterly lost track of where I'm at, and I'm sure you're all hungry. Let me just see. I might skip a little. So various reasons, I think, why we see this renewed interest in university museums. Some of them, I think, are to do with a greater recognition of the importance of public engagement, the kind of speaking out beyond the university. It's also, I think, recognized and seen as more important as part of, the image management of universities, especially in a time of increased kind of global awareness and even global competition. But there is, I think, increased recognition of the significance of a university's own cultural heritage. In a world in which heritage is increasingly becoming the currency for manifesting distinctiveness and cultural presence and legitimacy within a place, it makes good sense for universities to have a museum too. It performs the idea that they have a past worth valuing, and more than this, that what they're doing in the present is also worth projecting into the future. And as a cultural statement, that is quite powerful stuff, and the museum is quite a powerful mode or medium for doing that. And the fact actually that we can go to them, we can take our families, you can take visiting dignitaries to them, those aren't insignificant things. They are part of that. So the opportunity that museums provide for collective and social activities is another key thing that they do. And that's very against those predictions that thought that we would all prefer to be couch potatoes. We might like to just sit at home sometimes, but actually there's something different that happens when you get up and you go out there. But of course there's more too that university museums are good at that should be noted here. And when I worked at Manchester University, for me the chance to work with the museum staff was something I absolutely really valued, and my students did too. So they got the chance to do things like when exhibitions were being planned, to talk with curators, share ideas, and then to see how that worked through. The trip that we always did at the beginning of our museum anthropology course into the museum stores was, everybody just loved that. There is something about seeing behind the scenes of museums that is very, very special, I think. The other thing for me with my students is they all had the chance, well, in fact, they all had to, let's be more honest, to conduct an object biography, so to work with some object in the museum collections, mostly not ones that were on display, it could be, but part of the idea was they would really research that, and they worked with museum staff to do that, and they, in doing so, they also often came up with things that the museum staff hadn't known because the amount of resource of the staff wasn't so extensive. So the students were contributing to that. But what it gave students was a real sense of themselves actively engaging in that kind of research. And there was some really excellent work, and some of it was very useful for the museum as well. And every year there were students who'd had no interest really in museum work who then decided they did want to do that kind of work, and some are now doing so. Anyway, I'm going to give you one more example of a museum before just saying a couple of general things. And again, I wanted to choose one that had sort of made some impact on me in my life. And this is one that I visited just before I began in Manchester. And I thought I'd choose one that probably nobody would know about. So this is the Tang Museum in upstate New York in Saratoga Springs. Has anybody been there? No, oh, that's surprising, or not. So it's a small liberal arts college of the kind you get in the States. And actually, it's become really quite famous within the US. It opened in the year 2000. And it really has made quite a mark because of what they've done. Now, I visited as part of an event in 2006, and at that time, and I maybe should take this with me, I wanted to just see if we could just go and visit it briefly. They also have a very smart website as well. I like their website. It's a real model website, and it's also very cleverly designed, so you can't pinch any pictures off it, so I have to look at it in this way. But you see here, just some of the exhibitions. Now, what I wanted to do was do a search. Oops, let me do it like that. Oh, no. Oh, dear, I'm a Mac person now. I can't click your mouse. Oops. Haven't used a mouse for years. Right, come on. There we are. Wait a minute, must be the left one. Oh, dear. All right, it will work in a minute. It will work with Frau Allemeyer's. Yay, there we go. Right, okay. So if we just look here. I can do it better like that. Let's go. So the artist Fred Wilson had just had a residency at this point. And what for me, as somebody working in the field, Fred Wilson is just like, he's just done amazing, amazing stuff about museums. So they displayed, had earlier displayed one of a sort of retrospective of his work. What he does is he does installation work that often reflects upon the museum itself. And I won't go into this. You could look at it later if you're interested. But you can just see in this image here, these are museum guards without their heads, but you can tell what colour they are. And this is part of a very political take on the museum that he often has, and you have there Egyptian heads in varying shades of colours. Just as we're on this page, this exhibition is one that he helped students and staff with, and that was drawing on anthropological ideas about different ideas about the sky and heaven in different cultures. What if I go back? They have a very, very active exhibition program, and mostly what they do is quite short-running temporary exhibitions. I've gone on to the wrong year there. And I just wanted to show you one that came out after I was there. It's just gone out of my head what year it was. Yeah, it must be then. So when I was there, one of the exhibitions that was in the planning was this one, Molecules That Matter. It was particularly drawing on chemistry, and the chemistry professor there, Raymond Guigrere, or Ray, as is it going to show me the other pictures? Let's see. There was a picture, nice picture of Ray earlier. He might come back. While I was there, I was really, really struck in my conversation with Ray about his involvement in creating an exhibition. He told me he'd never been involved in such a thing before. And for him, he was so excited about that. And he said it made him really think about his discipline in a different way, not only about communicating it out to people, but actually thinking about some of his own research in other kinds of ways. And one of the things that's very impressive at the Tang is that they really set up they really, really actively use it for teaching. So students go and write labels, they do creative writing projects about exhibits and so on. But they also use it through the exhibitions that they do as a way of bringing together staff across disciplines. And that was something that you really had a very, very powerful sense of that going on. I'm just seeing if I can... I won't show you anymore because it's taking up time, but they have a really, really broad range of topics in which they are bringing people together. Now, it is quite an art-oriented museum, and it began with very few collections, but they have been building some up, primarily art. But I think it is a very interesting example. Now, when I went to the event, what was going to happen was that Fred Wilson was going to announce kind of what he was going to recommend for the museum for the future. Now, I have to say that at that time, I was actually quite disappointed because I thought he was going to come up with some new political artwork or something like that. But what he suggested or recommended was that at the center of the museum there should be a kind of modular exhibition space, exhibition units, so that people could create quite temporary exhibitions in quite a sort of provisional way, at least as I understood it. But what was really, really important, he really emphasized, was that there should also be a really top quality espresso machine, so you could go and get really excellent coffee. Now, since then, I've realized that actually that was very brilliant, because what he was really recognizing was that as a social space and as somewhere that would really bring people from across the campus and making it that engaging place, or building on its potential to be even more engaging. Okay then, now let me just go back to here. Just to turn then to being a little bit more sort of general and abstract about this, my original plan had actually been that I would talk about each of these, about how museums form particular kinds of ways of knowing because of certain features of them. But rather than doing that in any detail, let me just pick up on a few of those, all of which I think I've mentioned along the way, really. But beginning at the top with the point about materiality, the fact that museums have things, they have objects, is a really, really important matter. And it does mark them off as different in their potential for conveying knowledge and for being a kind of focal point around which you can gather different voices, you can bring together different kinds of engagements. Now, part of that, but it's definitely not the whole of that, is a set of ideas about the real thing and authenticity, and those ideas are very culturally powerful. The idea that the particular things that we're engaging with have endured or experienced a particular kind of life, that they have survived, perhaps, is partly what gives them a particular kind of frisson and power, and makes them especially compelling. Actually, it was only after I put together the examples from the Manchester Museum that I suddenly realized that 3 out of 4 of those were to do with dead bodies. And there, I think, we probably sense more powerfully than anything just what the power of an object can be, that we think about it. We think, yes, that was once somebody, and they lived. That they carry with them something of their histories, and that's very, very important. And that's also part of the temporality of the museum, the specific kind of temporalities that museums offer, the ways they bring the past into the present and they project it into the future. There is there too, I think, temporality in another sense that's quite important for the museum. When we go to a museum, it usually takes a bit of effort. We have to, you know, we have to get there. We have to plan a bit. We're there in a more kind of... when we're there, I think, our attention is sort of limited to other things. They're times of quite concentrated attention, which maybe is one of the reasons that they are becoming sort of growing in importance. In the world where we are constantly bombarded by many things, finding spaces where we really kind of can concentrate on one thing maybe is more and more important. That's just a supposition that I have. But that the act of going, the particular time that takes in our own daily life cycles, and moving into particular kinds of spaces, the architecture, the three-dimensionality of museums is partly how they work in the way that they work, and it is a very important matter. The fact that we actually move our bodies within it, and I put their corporeality as another particular kind of fact about the museum. All of those things make them different in the way they work from other kinds of embodied and spatial experiences that we have, such as watching television, being on the internet, being at a lecture. In a museum, we move through, we engage with, we operate our senses in particular ways. And those things, in general, I think, we still haven't theorized enough, those of us who work in museums. We still haven't done enough to know about how those things work, and I would hope there's space to do more of that. I already talked there about the sociality of the museum. Even if we're not visiting with other people, and of course we can visit with other people, but even if we're not, there are other people there, and people watching in museums is something that not only anthropologists do. Yeah, and Fred Wilson certainly not knew what he was doing with his proposal for the Tang. So all of this can be maybe captured in part in thinking about the museum as the relational museum, which is one of the terms that people quite often use these days. Okay then, so that's some of the things that museums do and they can do. I confess that I'm sometimes a little disappointed that they don't make the most of their potential, and maybe there are ways that we can try to do that and do that a bit better. Maybe, I'm nervous now. But here maybe I should say a little bit about what I am, I guess those things are relevant to my move to Berlin, and I thought you probably wouldn't let me get away without saying something about what my plans are as part of this Alexander von Humboldt Professur. So just to give a little bit of background, the prize lasts for 5 years, so until 2020, and part of that will involve setting up a new research centre, which I've given the name Karma, because I really want to get some very good karma on that. It's partly for the acronym. So it's called the Centre for Anthropological Research on Museums and Heritage. It's based in the Institut für Europäische Ethnologie, as was already said in the introduction. My actual formal title, interestingly, is Professor of Social Anthropology with particular emphasis on museum and cultural heritage studies. I didn't actually devise that by myself, but I'm very pleased with it. And how I understand anthropological. So I'm a social or cultural anthropologist, and to kind of boil it down, the two things that I see as really, really crucial and important to that are, on the one hand, taking a comparative perspective and really thinking about what goes on here compared with there. What are the alternatives? Why do we do what we do? What kinds of assumptions are involved? So really asking questions about things that we take for granted. And that's a very crucial part of anthropology. And it means looking globally and looking at places that maybe do things in very, very different ways, in very different cultures. The other side of it is something very different, which is looking in real, real depth within a particular place, looking for ought, as is said in German. I'm really looking at what are the actual practices and processes involved in what goes on. And by doing that, really, is trying to analyze what are the kind of deep suppositions about what's happening, who are the key players, why, what, and really trying to kind of look especially at the kind of gap between ideas and realizations. Why do things turn out as they do or not as we'd thought? What comes into play there? Within this, so the center is quite a broad thing, and the idea is that that will continue beyond the 5 years. You see there, its supporters, very important to say, so primarily funded by the Alexander von Humboldt Stiftung, obviously supported by the Humboldt University. Partners who contributed to the application to the Alexander von Humboldt Stiftung, but who will also provide some extra posts, the Berlin Museum für Naturkunde and the Stiftung Preußischer Kulturbesitz. The core of the work is a particular research project, and that's really what the core funding goes towards. And that's its title there. And basically what it is a multi-researcher ethnography, so a studying of what goes on, of the ongoing museum and heritage developments in Berlin. We'll look especially at what's going on in relation to the partner organisations, but not only. And it is quite important that we really think about how museums play out within the city, different constituencies, different populations, and also think about what doesn't get attention and relatively neglected and hidden heritage as well there. So there are four key themes to the research program. So the first, transforming the ethnographic, is especially concerned with what happens to the ethnological collections, what's involved in what's selected and displayed in the center, including what the politics of this are. Representing Islam, obviously a very, very topical matter. Actually, we see globally numerous new museums and exhibitions about Islam. How you display that, what's involved, again, it's obviously of considerable political and social significance, and there it's a challenge for museums in Berlin as elsewhere. Science and citizenship is taking a broader kind of cross-cutting look at how do we try to convey knowledge, scientific knowledge, and what does that mean for people's sense of citizenship, of what, how can we enable people, or how are people enabled or not by different kinds of activities by museums. Media, mediation, maybe it should be material culture there too, is particularly concerned with the forms that museums take and what we could do, how we can think about different, the effects of particular display styles, also questions maybe like the use of new media and so on. I'm putting it in a nutshell, but I'm hoping that my website with more information will go live very, very soon, so you can go and have a look at more of that. And of course, as we get going, we'll put up more materials. So basically, for each of those areas, there'll be a couple of researchers on each, either a junior professor and a doctoral student, or a postdoc and a doctoral student. And in case there are people here who are looking for jobs, I will be advertising very, very soon for two postdocs, one each on the transforming the ethnographic theme and one on the representing Islam theme. Those other two themes there will have junior professors, and the adverts for them will be as soon as I can get through the bureaucratic maze, but I'm getting there. Key parts of the research, though. So for an anthropologist, it's quite challenging because what we want to do is not just observe and look and see what's happening, though that's very, very crucial and important part of the work, but we do want, as far as people might be wishing us to do that, to participate, trying to make sure that as we do so, we really reflect upon that and really develop that, those modes of being both engaged and, as I put it there, some kind of ongoing criticality. And that might include being involved in experimental forms of exhibition as part of the formative development, and visitor research as part of that, but really leading towards as well trying to bring together research on museums, developing that in itself, and as part of that also developing, especially for beyond 2020, particular kinds of modes of learning and teaching involving museums. So, in essence, in that project, the focus will be on Berlin, but also looking more widely elsewhere to see what museums do, sometimes without them even realizing what they're doing, including the various kinds of differences, be they questions about social diversity, biodiversity, or whatever, that they are kind of mobilizing, and then the differences that they make within society. So we also want to think about what they can do and what they might be able to do, including, hopefully, things that none of us have even thought of so far, and what kinds of roles we can play within that. But let's see what we managed to do by 2020 and then beyond. To return to Back to the Future, where I began this lecture, it's interesting, I think, to contemplate what might be the future of museums in 30 years' time. Well, we've already heard that it's quite dangerous to make predictions, but at least I think we could do this, couldn't we? I think we could predict that museums will be around in 30 years' time. And I'd like to also predict that they will be even more interesting and dynamic. But let's see, what is the future? You'll have to invite me back in 30 years' time, in 2045, to see if I'm right or not. Thank you very much.
Das war eine Aufzeichnung der gestrigen Ringvorlesung. Es sprach Professor Dr. Sharon MacDonald aus Berlin und York zum Thema What Museums Can Do. Nächsten Mittwoch am 4. November hören Sie Privatdozent Dr. Mike Reich aus München mit seinem Thema Das Akademische Museum Göttingen, ein Vorbild der Moderne.